From NPR West in Culver City, California, you're listening to the podcast edition of All Things Considered, the best picks from our programs on Saturday and Sunday. I'm Eric Westervelt. In this episode, we talk to a nurse with Doctors Without Borders about the difficulties of battling the deadliest outbreak of Ebola on record.
They were the first in line. They were taking the most risks, and they didn't know if they had been infected already.
He's a tough guy in movies like Machete and From Dusk Till Dawn. We talked to Danny Trejo for this week's edition of My Big Break.
This guy comes up to me and says, "Hey, can you act like a convict?" I says, "I'll give it a shot."
And there's a new biopic out about the godfather of soul, James Brown. We revisit what is arguably Brown's greatest live act, his performance at the 1964 TAMI Awards.
It's a really phenomenal performance. You need to see this.
That and more on this podcast edition of All Things Considered from NPR West. The first of two American aid workers infected with the Ebola virus arrived at a hospital in Atlanta. They'll be treated at a special isolation unit at Emory University Hospital. In West Africa, the toll from the deadly outbreak has topped 700, with hundreds more infected in the three nations most affected by the outbreak. NPR's Ofebia Quist-Arkton is monitoring developments from her base in Senegal, and she joins us now. Ofebia, what's the latest on the regional response to what global health officials are calling really the worst outbreak of Ebola?
This past week, Sierra Leone and Liberia before it have imposed tough new measures. They say they're going to use the army and the police to quarantine communities, zones, and even homes at the epicenters of the virus. And they're warning people that they have to bring their loved ones to a health center. Also, three presidents met on Friday. They said that they're going to do much more at the border crossings to screen people coming in and out, and that will also happen at the airports into Sierra Leone, Liberia, and the third country affected, Guinea.
Ofebia, this latest outbreak was first reported in February. You reported in March that Doctors Without Borders in Guinea was already feeling overwhelmed. It's August. Why did it take African and world health officials months to mobilize an aggressive response to this very serious situation?
We've got to remember that this is a region that is emerging from deadly, devastating civil wars. So they're already dealing with all sorts of problems. Ebola, on top of it, has made people frightened, jittery. They are nervous, and there is a lot of suspicion. Many health workers are saying there has not been enough sensitization and awareness campaigns. And then there is the possibility of survival. So mixed messages and confusion have led to people keeping their loved ones at home, hidden even, so much so that Liberia and Sierra Leone have said that we'll prosecute you if you do not bring those suffering or thought to be suffering from Ebola to centers where they can be cared for.
As you point out, local authorities are up against some fear, worry, confusion, and ignorance. Briefly, Ofebia, what are the biggest cultural hurdles in battling Ebola in West Africa that you've seen?
The one that's most mentioned is traditional burial rituals, where, of course, you wash down the body of your loved one who has died. Now, that is a way that Ebola spreads easily. And people don't want to give up. You know, that is the way they have looked after their dead for hundreds of years, suddenly being told no, you can't touch them, and that they must be buried in a hole in the ground is absolute anathema. And that's why many people are saying, who brought this disease to West Africa? It was the white health workers. That's why we have seen that health centers run by Westerners have been attacked. People who are trying to help the communities have been attacked because it's not known in this region, and people just trying to get used to it, but it's obviously tough.
NPR's Ofebia Quist-Arkton with us from Dakar. Thank you, Ofebia.
Always a pleasure.
Monia Saya is a nurse working with the aid organization Doctors Without Borders. She's just returned from Guinea, where this outbreak first started. I asked her what she's seen there.
What we saw at the beginning there was disbelief, a lot of fear from the population, especially the healthcare workers. They understood that something was very wrong and that they were the first in line. They were taking the most risks, and they didn't know if they had been infected already because the incubation period can be up to 21 days. So a lot of fear and a lot of concern.
And Ebola is highly contagious. The head of the World Health Organization this week said there's a high risk it will continue to spread. Tell us what you know about the disease and how it's spread.
The Ebola virus, the subtype of the strain we're dealing with at the moment in West Africa, is the Zaire strain, and it's the most deadly, I would say, of the different types of Ebola viruses that we know about. And how Ebola is spread is through direct contact. It must be a direct contact. It is not airborne. It is not like the flu. So a person to be infected, the person has to be in direct contact with bodily fluids of the sick person.
So what is the biggest challenge you saw in trying to contain the outbreak?
There are many layers to an intervention into containing an outbreak, whether small or large. There are many components, such as having a treatment facility, of course, to treat the affected people, but also to isolate the virus so that we can break chains of transmissions. The education, educating the communities about what is Ebola and how it is spread and how they can protect themselves and what should they do if someone shows symptoms, that they need to come to the facilities as early as possible. We need to make sure that when a case tested positive, that we trace anyone who's been in contact with that person during the sickness needs to be followed for 21 days to make sure that they do not develop symptoms. And if they do develop symptoms, that they're brought to a facility in order to be tested.
A large number of cases involve people exposed in medical facilities. This includes Sierra Leone's top doctor who died of Ebola this week. Tell us about the precautions you and other medical workers have to take when treating the sick.
We use PPE, personal protective equipment, and what that is gowns and two pairs of gloves, rubber boots, goggles, hoods, masks. And when we were about to go inside the high-risk area, everything is very organized and very square. We know what we're going to do and why we're going to do it. We go in with as a buddy system, much like when we're diving. So in case the other person is about to make a mistake or trip or faint, because working conditions are quite difficult, it's very hot, we get dehydrated because we sweat a lot inside those suits, and we limit the amount of time that we're inside the high-risk zone. We can't just stay 2 hours. At least for me, I can't.
There's no cure or vaccine, and there's a high mortality rate, but there are survivors in this outbreak. I mean, have you seen this in your experience, people recovering?
Yes, we see people surviving. I won't say cured because they were not cured, they just survived. What we do is supportive care inside a treatment facility. So if a patient is dehydrated, we rehydrate. If there's any side infection, then bacterial infection, then we'll give antibiotics. And we'll try everything we can to boost their immune system so that their body can fight against the virus.
What would you like to see on the ground? What could be improved on?
We need more people. We need more actors to be involved in educating the population, the communities, sensitizing them about the fact that the key to resolving this is that people come and get treated and not hide their sick and not have secret burials. We have a lot of work ahead. It's now in 3 countries and multiple sites. We've never seen it before. Doctors Without Borders has stretched its capacity to respond. We're doing the best we can, but I think many more actors need to be mobilized.
Monia Sayah is a nurse with Doctors Without Borders. She's on a break from her work in Guinea and plans to head back soon. Monia, thanks for taking the time with us, and stay safe.
Thank you.
The National Basketball Association is made up of 30 teams. That's 30 head coaches, and all of them men. But Natalie Nakase hopes to change that. The 34-year-old Nakase is currently the assistant video coordinator for the NBA's Los Angeles Clippers. Before that, she played women's basketball professionally and even coached a men's team in Japan. But a few weeks ago, just before the start of the NBA's Summer League, Clippers head coach Doc Rivers called Nakase into his office and changed her life.
He just said, okay, I'm going to make this quick. And I was like, all right, I'm thinking like I did something wrong because I usually don't go into his office that much. He just pulled me in and he just said, would you want to coach Summer League? And I said, what? Like, I just, you know, my first response was like a shock. And then I said, yes, right away.
Your goal is to be a head coach in the NBA. One commentator said there won't be a female NBA coach until there's a lawsuit. Do you worry you're going to run into a glass ceiling that will only be broken through litigation?
No, I actually don't worry, because I think if I did worry, it would kind of distract me from my goal. You know, your mind is so strong that if, you know, you have one, like, negative thought about what you want to do, it's going to kind of put you in a reverse, you know, reverse direction. So I continue to believe every day that I could do it, and then I just stay focused on what I want to do.
You were one of the first Asian American women to play in professional basketball. I mean, what inspired you to want to become a coach?
It actually just happened. I didn't want to become a coach at the young age that I was. I wanted to keep playing as long as I could. I always told myself that I wanted to just keep playing because that's the best job, I think, in the world, is to play basketball and get paid for it. So I did that, and then I hurt my knee a second time. And so when I hurt my knee the second time, I didn't want to go through the rehab again. So it was kind of like a blessing in disguise.
What's it like being on the bench? You know, you're 5'2" with these are giant basketball players, these giant men.
When they sit down is probably the best time where I can, you know, really get into their ear because they're sitting and they're like leveled to me. But, you know, they don't ever say anything in terms of like my height, or they don't say anything. As long as, you know, they trust me and I bring value to help them winning and then helping them to make them play better. You know, if I say the right things and things that can help them, then they'll listen no matter how tall I am or, you know, if I'm a female.
Obviously, the LA Clippers have been through one heck of a year, Natalie, with the ouster of team owner Donald Sterling after these recordings of him making racist and sexist remarks. Has that added an extra layer of stress and distraction to this job? It must have.
For me, no. He was never around, so I really had no connection with him. And so for me, I was so focused on coaching the Summer League, I didn't have any chance to think.
So you're coaching the Summer League. I mean, will you be on the Clippers bench this October, this fall, when the NBA season begins?
Not that I know of. Doc, you know, assigned me as being assistant video coordinator this year. And, you know, whatever Doc needs, I'm going to do. So if he wants me to be the best at that job, then I'm going to do that and help him win the championship. If he, you know, wants to put me in a different situation, like on the bench or on the floor, then, you know, I'm just going to be prepared to do it. So I'm more like given an opportunity, okay, do the best you can at that position and not kind of, you know, go forward unless given the opportunity.
That's Natalie Nicasse. She's the assistant coach for the LA Clippers Summer League and the team's assistant video coordinator. Natalie, good luck and thanks for coming on the show.
Oh, thank you. Thanks for having me.
There's a new James Brown biopic out, Get On Up. But arguably the greatest James Brown video is his real performance, the 1964 TAMI Awards, a predecessor to today's Teen Choice Awards. And everyone who was anyone was there.
We'd like to start it off tonight with a fantastic act, the guy who started it all back in 1958, Chuck Berry.
The Pacemakers.
The Fantastic Miracles.
The dynamic Marvin Gaye.
USA.
Huge act after huge act. The last band to play that night in 64 was a popular new group, the Rolling Stones. But not before the godfather of soul stole the whole show.
James Brown and his famous flames!
Eugene Robinson writes about what happened next in his latest article for the online magazine Ozzy. Eugene, hello.
Hey, how are you?
So set the scene for us here. I mean, you write, when giants get together, things are bound to roil under the surface. Roiling this night in 64, James Brown doesn't open for anyone, let alone some kids from England, right?
Yeah, it's just great to imagine, you know, that conversation where the producer of the show cajoled them into saying, look, it'll be great. The kids come for the Rolling Stones. They know them. You know, James, this will be good for you. And you can just kind of feel James go, I'll show you who it'll be good for.
Right.
It'll be good for James Brown. That's who it'll be good for. It was really, really major miscalculations up there with General George Custer, you know.
So Brown's second song that night is his big hit at that time, Please, Please, Please. The video of this is nuts, you know. He goes wild. The crowd's losing it, all because of the cape routine. Describe what's happening on stage, Eugene.
James would drop to his knees in the middle of Please, Please, Please. One of the famous flames would kind of come and pat him on the back to see if he was okay, help him to his feet, put the cape over his shoulders. James would take a couple of steps, shuck the cape off, make the break back to the mic, and finish, drop again, and they would repeat this thing like two or three times. And at one point, during like the apex of it, he's repeating one word for about five measures. Just I. And the cape is, I mean, it's electrifying from every single vantage point. It's a really phenomenal performance. You need to see this.
And by the end of this, Brown can barely walk. He's danced so hard, the crowd is going hysterical. And, you know, the Rolling Stones have to follow this. I can almost see a young, you know, Mick and Keith standing in the wings just looking at each other and saying, man, how do we follow that?
Well, Keith Richards himself has gone on record as having said that this was the worst career mistake he had ever made. Mick and Keith, they look shell-shocked. Shell-shocked, you know. I mean, can you imagine standing back there in the wings and watching James Brown drop to his knees three or four times during Please, Please, Please? I mean, it's electrifying to watch now, and I can't imagine having been there. I'd have lost my mind, most assuredly.
Eugene Robinson of the online magazine Ozzy remembering James Brown's legendary performance at the 1964 TAMI award ceremony. The new biopic about the singer's life is called Get On Up. It's out this weekend. Eugene, thank you.
Hey, thank you.
Please, 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 please.
Anthony Matthews is something of a master when it comes to the complaint letter. Over the years, he's become almost obsessed with them, writing to customer relations departments of car companies, hotels, and airlines, all with surprisingly successful results.
Dear customer relations, just imagine it.
That's Anthony reading from his first letter, composed on a typewriter 25 years ago. It was about his luxury car that was falling apart, breakdowns, oil leaks, smoke from the air vents. The worst part, the heater was stuck on full blast in the middle of summer. He had to keep his windows rolled down to keep cool. Then he got caught in what he describes as a storm of biblical proportions, and his windows wouldn't roll up.
There you are, cruising along the motorway. Your left side in the full blast of the heater is slowly cooking to a perfect medium rare. Your right side is immersed in a torrent of cold water hitting you at 70 miles an hour. The car is slowly filling with water. Your sauna is turning into a paddling pool.
You got a positive response. They actually fixed the car.
Completely, yeah. They took the car away for a whole month and they basically rebuilt it from the chassis upwards. And that was the start of it all.
Now, to many, you're a customer relations hero, but do friends and family ever say, Anthony, you've gone a little bonkers here?
Oh, regularly, yes. But at the end of the day, it's all about having a bit of fun, really. And these days, a lot of people send their complaints to me. And so I have great fun on a weekend going through my inbox with some of the stuff that's flying around the world. It's great.
Another one of your letters was about your local milkman, a guy named Barry, kind of the milkman from hell, so to speak. Tell us about Barry.
Yeah, he'd been ruining our sleep for many years. This guy delivered milk in the middle of the night, and this guy used to fly into the cul-de-sac in his noisy vehicle in first gear and reverse back out again and make the most unholy racket. And so I wrote a letter to his boss when I found their website and actually found out that Barry was indeed called Barry. So I asked for them to keep him quiet, basically.
So, Anthony, let's hear a little bit from that letter.
He enters the cul-de-sac in first gear, with foot to the floor, brakes abruptly, jumps out to make his delivery, and then reverses back the way he came with the needle on his rev counter, well into the red zone, before he performs a quick handbrake turn and then back to first gear before screaming off down the street to wake up other people. Barry evidently has yet to discover second, third and fourth gears. He may as well deliver the milk in a Harrier jump jet.
So what happened after you sent that in?
He had to stop at the end of the street and carry the milk in on foot.
Success. It seems like you have a particularly British approach to this. Americans are much more likely to fire off an angry letter saying, you know, give us our refund. You're using humor, sarcasm, and irony to try to get what you want.
Yeah, I think it's a British trait. And in terms of writing a complaint letter, there are a number of recommendations I would make. One of them is humor. First thing is, write a real letter, not an email. Because you can't delete an envelope. And people get too much email, so for letters, these days they don't get many letters, so your letter stands out, and it's worth doing.
Recently, a painful Comcast cable customer service call in the U.S. made the rounds of social media. Did you happen to hear it?
Oh, I did, yes.
So let's take a listen.
I'm just trying to figure out here what it is about Comcast service that you're not liking, that you're not wanting to keep. I mean, why is it that you don't want to keep that service?
This phone call is a really actually amazing representative example of why I don't want to stay with Comcast.
So, Anthony, if you'd been on the other end of that line, how would you have handled that call?
The first thing I think I would have done is made sure I had his name. So let's call him Mike for the sake of this conversation. We're all programmed to divert our attention immediately when we hear our name. So the first thing I would do is I would use his name a lot. I think, as I understand it, most of these guys who do his job, they're not allowed to actually put the phone down. It has to be the customer. So you can then reverse it and keep him talking for another 20 minutes.
Go for a nice walk, go out to dinner, leave the phone on.
Indeed.
Anthony Matthews, master of the complaint letter. He's working on a book compiling complaint letters from around the world over the years, titled Dear Customer Relations. Anthony, thanks for joining us.
You're very welcome. It's been a pleasure.
Time now for the latest installment of our series, My Big Break, about career triumphs big and small. Danny Trejo is the tough guy in action movies like Machete and From Dusk Till Dawn. His first role was playing a convict in the 1985 film Runaway Train. He was perfect for the part. Before Trejo was an actor, he was an inmate doing time in prisons across California.
And when I was in drugs, alcohol, robberies, burglary, and whatever you had, any way to make money, when you're being pushed by a drug habit, it's like you just don't care. Prison is all about status. Armed robber and your dope dealer in prison. They have the biggest status, you know, it goes down from there, you know what I mean? And the boxer, the guy, if you're boxing, people are betting on you, people, so you automatically have a status. I could box really good, and so every prison I went to, they would always, oh yeah, come on, and I'd end up boxing, you know, and I would tail lightweight in the welterweight championship every institution I was in. There was a riot, and it was alleged that I hit Lieutenant Givens in the head with a rock, and so we got sent to the hole, and basically those are all gas chamber offenses. You know, I had a little reputation on the yard in prison, so I just remember asking God to please let me die with dignity, and if he would do that, I would promise to say his name every day, help anybody I could any way I can. And was a DJ reject. They had no witnesses. There was no 3,000 inmates. They had no witnesses. You know what I mean? And by the grace of God, you know, I got out. And I ain't look back. I dedicated my life to helping other people. And I was a drug counselor. And one of the kids that I was working with, about 18 years old, he called me and said, hey, I'm having a big problem down here. There's a lot of cocaine. It was like crazy, you know. So 11 o'clock at night, I went down and I just started hanging out with him, you know. I was his support system, that's all. He gave me the address to a warehouse, so I thought he worked in a warehouse, you know. And I get there and he comes out. It's a movie set of a movie called Runaway Train with John Voight and Eric Robertson.
You're gonna get a job. That's what you're going to do. You're going to get a little job, some job a convict can get.
I stand there. This guy comes up to me and says, hey, do you want to be in this movie? And I says, what do I got to do? He says, do you want to be an extra? And I said, an extra what? And he says, can you act like a convict? I says, I'll give it a shot. You know, I mean, I've been in every penitentiary in the state. It was kind of funny. You know? They gave me a blue shirt. I took off my shirt. And he saw this big tattoo I have in my chest. You know, it's like the most famous tattoo in the world. It's a Mexican lady with a sombrero. It's a charra. They were the ones that rode with Pancho Villa. This guy comes over and says, hey, you're Danny Trejo. And I go, yeah. He says, I saw you win the lightweight and the welterweight title up in San Quentin. It's a real famous fight. And I knew this guy, right? I said, you're Eddie Bunker. And I said, hey, Eddie. He says, what are you doing here? He says, Danny, I adapted the screenplay. And he says, hey, are you still boxing? I says, I train. He says, we need somebody to train one of the actors how to box. And I started training Eric Roberts how to box for the movie Runaway Train. Me and Eric got along, and the director saw that we got along, so He says, comes up, you fight Eric. You be in movie. You fight Eric.
Jab! Punch!
You know what? It's like a divine intervention, I think, man. You know what I mean? Because for me to meet Eddie Bunker on a movie set, it's amazing. You know, when you talk about my big break, you know, I've had a few of them in my life. Everything good that has ever happened to me has happened as a direct result of helping someone else. Everything.
Actor Danny Trejo, by the way, he still works for a rehab center as director of patient relations. You don't have to be a movie star. We want to hear your story. Tell us your big break. We might just put you on the air. Send us an email at mybigbreak@npr.org. The price of a college education in America is soaring. Student loan debt is as well. And about a third of recent college graduates are either underemployed or jobless. Many are asking, is the price of a college education worth it? Is a liberal arts education still relevant? Are universities preparing students for today's high-tech cloud and mobile-first economy? Wesleyan University President Michael Roth is the author of the new book, Beyond the University, Why Liberal Education Matters. He says that debate over vocational versus a wider education was raging even back in Thomas Jefferson's day.
This tension between the useful and the wide-ranging, that tension goes all the way back to the founding of this country. Because even though Jefferson and Emerson, let's say, were very much in favor of a wide-ranging and broad education, they also thought the proof was in the pudding. That is, you had to be able to do something with it. And you know, Jefferson talked about the useful arts, and he just thought you're going to be less useful or less pragmatic if you narrowed yourself too early.
But some young men and women today will look at the modern economy and say, look, some of the most successful businessmen out there, Bill Gates and the late Steve Jobs, you know, they didn't graduate from college. They made it happen on their own.
Yes. And there are people who win the lottery and they don't have to go to college either. And there are people who just think, you know, some of us don't really need a lot of education. Most people today need something more specialized because the economy has shifted. Eric, throughout American history, people have said, yes, it's because the economy has shifted. They said that in 1918. They said that in 1948. And now they're saying it again. Today, the shifts in the economy mean that technological change will only produce accelerated pace of innovation, of changing relations to audiences. A broad, wide-ranging education is the best way to be able to shape that change rather than just be victimized by it.
Anti-intellectualism is an enduring tradition in America, but so is Ben Franklin's critique of the Ivy League. I mean, he called
yes.
Harvard students, you know, rich and lazy, in his words, blockheads. He wrote that Harvard students, quote, learn little more than how to carry themselves handsomely and enter a room genteelly. Part of that critique of a liberal arts education is still with us today, no?
Absolutely. And it's an important critique because if left to our own devices, we academics might, you know, become more and more out of touch with what the society really needs. You know, that tradition of criticizing elitists, criticizing the kind of snobbery that sometimes goes with elite education, that's, I think, a very healthy American tradition for good democratic reasons.
Your book is not about the cost or really the impact of a college education today, but cost and efficacy are huge issues. In a recent scathing article in the New Republic, William Drezewitz writes, the U.S. system of elite higher ed is, quote, exacerbating inequality, retarding social mobility, perpetuating privilege, and creating an elite isolated from the society it's supposed to lead. Does he have a point?
He has a very good point. Higher education in the United States has traditionally functioned as a vehicle for social mobility. And as costs have escalated and financial aid has not kept up with those costs, elite education has become a way of cementing privilege rather than opening up elite to more voices, more talents.
And you stay active in the classroom teaching. I mean, you teach both in the classroom and a massive open online course or a MOOC at Wesleyan. I mean, why not tap into MOOCs more to help people get some of the same knowledge at a lower price? What role do these MOOCs play in higher education today, in your view?
I found the teaching of these massive open online classes an extraordinarily powerful experience as a teacher. I've gotten to know many students online. It's not the same thing as giving a seminar. Far from it. In fact, many of my students in the MOOC say, well, can I come to Wesleyan and have this education in a much more purified, if you will, or distilled form? But I think that the MOOCs are a great experiment in bringing educational practices to a wide variety of audiences. And I think it's just incumbent upon those of us who are in education to try new modes of teaching that would maintain a high level of engagement, but might reduce cost and might expand the number of people who benefit from what we have to offer.
Michael Roth is the president of Wesleyan University and the author of Beyond the University, Why Liberal Education Matters. Mr. Roth, thanks a lot for talking with us.
Thank you very much, Eric.
From a little girl at the age of six, I made up my mind that I'm going to be a singer.
And that's just what Naomi Shelton did. She sang in churches in the Deep South. She sang in nightclubs in Brooklyn year after year after year. But the record industry never came calling. That is, until Naomi Shelton was in her 60s. That's when the specialty soul label Daptone discovered kindred spirits in Shelton and her backup singers, the Gospel Queens.
All my money gone and spent. I got love.
That's from Naomi Shelton's new album, Cold World. She grew up in Alabama and Florida, singing in the church. But she really fell for those artists who took the spirit of the church into the world of pop and soul music.
Listen to Sam Cooke, the Staple Singers, James Brown, Otis Redding, Wilson Pickett. So I got inspired through those singers years ago.
Sam Cooke, Wilson Pickett, Otis Redding, I mean, those are secular folks. A lot of gospel lovers at the time were a bit scandalized by those secular singers. What did you think back then? You fell in love with them.
I fell in love because, you know what, I listened to the lyrics. And more so, a lot of people listen to just the beat of a song, but I listen to the words because the words is what has meaning. And I always liked the song, I know one day change's going to come. And I held on to that all of my life until I got 66 years old when my first CD came out. And it's from my background, I guess, from my family in Alabama that kept me inspired in church. And then once I left home, graduated, then I just kept it going and from one club to another until I said one day somebody would recognize me and then I would not give up. And I just kept it moving, that faith.
Keep me moving.
Was there any tension in the family saying, you know, Naomi, you got to get back to the church?
I tell you, when I told my dad, I did show business for many, many years, and I told my dad, by the way, before he went on Home to Glory, that I was in the club. So he said to me, you know, daughter, don't worry about it, because as long as the heart don't change. He said, as long as it's all about love, keep doing what you're doing.
Well, I'm standing by the train station with my ticket in my hand. I know this train bound for the promised land.
You know, I love the song. I love a lot of the tunes off your album, but Bound for the Promised Land is great. It's gospel. It's a little bit of rock and roll, R&B. How much of this new album is going to church and how much is going to the club?
I just figure whichever way it's going to go. Some may go to church, some may go to the club. I call it soul music. It's a music about on this journey, the journey that you take it in life. But it's all about the message that's in the song.
And I've been down all on level, y'all, to the ground. I try not to do the things I do. Oh, Lord, I'm waiting on you.
I'm waiting on you.
Please hear my plea.
Now, Naomi, you've been singing for a long time, but it really wasn't until recently that you started to make it big and went national. Your first record with the Gospel Queens came out in 2009, and you toured all over the world since then. Is this something you wish, you know, had happened to you when you were in your 20s or 30s, that you had sort of gotten big earlier?
Well, you know what? People ask me that all the time, and like I tell them, nothing's going to happen to that season. And it has nothing to do with age. I knew one day, whether I'd be in my 60s, 70s, whatever, one day, God gonna move me into a spot. And he did. So I just just had patient waiting and kept on doing what I was doing.
But do you bring something to a song now that maybe you couldn't have brought to a song as a younger woman?
Yeah, because now I have got much more mature now, and a lot of things I can relate to better than I did when I was much younger. A lot of things I can see clearly. I can see more than what I did years ago.
Any examples from this album?
Songs like, you know, I'm a Sinner. Hmm. Because this way we all are sinners, and we have God to forgive us of our sin, and one day we want to be able to meet our Savior.
I'm a sinner, yes I am.
I like the song Humble Me as well. That's a great tune.
Humble Me, from that song, I ask God every day because of how high I get. Let me stay humble. Let me be able to greet those people and love those people who helped me on the way to get me where I am. That I don't ever want to get too high where I pass you by. Keep me humble.
Stay grounded. Remember where you come from.
Exactly.
When I start talking down, like I'm hovering above. What you made
up. You said once, my occupation is singing, but my other occupation is going out in the field, helping others whatever way I can. What do you mean by that?
You know, because there's a lot of time that people come to you, they say, you know, your song really inspired me, and can you just pray for me? And that's what I mean, helping people, that, you know, you just got to be able to reach out, other than not get too high, that you don't have time to spend with people, because there's something people want to talk about. And my whole mission is, if I can help somebody along my way, then my living will not be in vain.
Don't let me forget about who I am.
That's Naomi Shelton. She and the Gospel Queens just released a new album. It's called Cold World. Ms. Shelton, it was a pleasure speaking with you.
Thank you so much. Thank y'all for having me.
More than the rest. When I start the morning, y'all.
For the week ending August 3rd, 2014, that's the podcast edition of All Things Considered from NPR West, the best of our programs from the weekend. The production staff includes Phil Harrell, Tom Dreisbach, Becky Sullivan, Daniel Hajek, Becky Hersher, and Denise Guerra. Our intern is Jen Velez. Patrick Murray is the technical director with support from Marcia Caldwell. Muthoni Muturi is senior editor, and Steve Lichtai is senior producer. I'm Eric Westerveld. Remember, you can always hear the show on your local public radio station. Thanks for listening.
Let me be grateful for all that I've seen. All that I have, y'all. Everywhere I've been. Now make me grateful for my voice.
Every day I need you for my guide.
Don't ever let me get too high so I can pass you by. No.
I need you by my side.
Help me to show love everywhere.